This is the noise of the laughing kookaburra. Its telltale call, which starts off as a low, hiccuping chuckle before revving up into a shrill, full-blown giggling fit. Even if you don't live anywhere near a kookaburra population, you might find this sound familiar. It has been used for years as a sound effect in the film industry, appearing in Tarzan movies from the 30s, The Wizard of Oz, The Lost World, Airplane, and The Naked Gun.
And if it was, did he know about it? And if he didn't, who did? And where the hell was I?
Its weird monkey-like laugh has become sound effect shorthand for not being in Kansas anymore. So while you will find the laughing kookaburra in Australia, its call is famous all over the world. Frieda Hughes was living in Australia when she wrote today's poem, and in it she asks what exactly a laughing kookaburra is without its famous noise. Hello and welcome to Ear Read This, Edinburgh's most powerful book podcast. I'm Ash, your host, and today I'll be talking about the poem Kookaburra by Frieda Hughes. Kookaburra appeared in Hughes' debut collection of poetry, which is called Warraloo, which is the name of the small hamlet where Frieda Hughes lived for several years in Western Australia before emigrating back to the UK. It's a poem which is a strange reflection on the nature of death, prompted by the poem's narrator discovering the body of a kookaburra left like a taunt outside a deserted chicken run. What interests me about this poem, first of all, is its mixture of the ghoulish and the ridiculous. Even in death, the kookaburra with its odd-shaped head and its famously human-sounding laugh retains an element of the absurd. Hughes's most recent book isn't another poetry collection, but a memoir of raising a magpie she rescued in her current home of Wales. And from her poems, reminiscences, and sketches of George the Magpie, I very much got the impression that Frieda Hughes has a knack for observing crafty, mischievous birds at work. And that same knack is evidenced here in her poem about a kookaburra. In that memoir, she also reflected on her astonishing literary pedigree, as it is described on the blurb of Warraloo. She says at one point that she is conventionally introduced at parties as Frieda Hughes, daughter of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, in one breath, and that she gets the impression that after a while, people are stopping just short of asking, "And how are your famous dead parents?" But there's no use being coy about it. Of course, I am also interested in this poem in terms of how it relates to the work of both Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. On the Hughes side, Kookaburra is a title of a poem that you could well imagine fitting in amongst one of Ted Hughes's collections, perhaps his Primer of Birds, with its long list of just one-word titles, just the name of a bird, or any other animal, not a pike or a bullfrog, but pike, as if it is not only speaking for a single specimen, but addressing the essence of the entire species. The name of Frieda Hughes's first collection, Warraloo, also seems to echo a collection of her father's, Wodwow. Strange, thorny, W-heavy words. Wodwow meaning wild man in Britain, and Warraloo being an Australian Aboriginal word, meaning something like you will return. Ted Hughes's poem, View of a Pig, features a similar confrontation with the shocking spectacle of a dead animal, except that, unlike her father's pig, Frieda Hughes's kookaburra is not too factually dead. It's not dead beyond pity. Instead, it retains something of a self, even if that is a reduced and transformed self. And here I think kookaburra resembles more the poetry of her mother, Sylvia Plath, and the way in which her work often framed death as a kind of magical conversion. So as I go through the poem today, I'll talk a little bit about what I think kookaburra has in common with the poetry of Frieda Hughes's parents, but also what it doesn't. Frieda Hughes was quite emphatic about not wanting to follow in the footsteps of her parents. She thought their styles were very different. She didn't think her poetry resembled her parents, especially when she began her career. She didn't think she had anything in common with her parents' poetry. She said she'd never read her parents' poetry until after Warraloo had been published, which I think is quite understandable, not just from a poet's terms, but also from a child's terms, a daughter. She said in an interview that she didn't want to read her parents' work and read studies of her parents, because to her they were mum and dad, and studying them in that way would make them more remote. At the same time, to find her own artistic voice and personality, she needed to be somewhere where there wasn't the constant association of her famous parents. It's one of the reasons she said she moved to Australia, was to go somewhere where her parents were strangers. Australia presented a new landscape for Frieda Hughes to create art in, and also a new bestiary, one that hadn't been raided by either of her parents for their own animal poems. So let's dive into the poem. I'll go through it stanza by stanza as usual, pausing after each one to discuss. There are four stanzas and then a short couplet at the end. So here is the first stanza. So big in life, head like a chopping block, beak like a carving knife, his hysterical voice cracked branches, his laugh stripped bark from the wood borers. So immediately we're talking about the kookaburra's size. Physically, it seems to be quite imposing, a beak like a carving knife, head like a chopping block, almost like a knife lying or lodged in its block. But more important than physical size is the size of its voice. This big, strong laugh that strips bark off trees and cracks branches. So it was the kookaburra's voice that gave it the impression of being big in life. It was big in proportion to the noise coming out of its mouth. Frieda Hughes does something similar, but the other way around, in another poem in Warraloo, Bird, where she says that the bird had a maw with a jaw as wide as whatever entered. So instead of being as large as whatever came out of the mouth, it was large as whatever came in. This was a bird that's size is relative to its appetite, not its noise. So despite having a beak like a carving knife, a head like a chopping block, it's the voice that Frieda Hughes characterizes as stripping bark and cracking branches, presumably to get at these wood borers, which would be like wood beetles or woodworm in the larval form, which would be food for the kookaburra. Great image, that, of a bark-stripping laugh. You will probably have heard some version of the famous folk song Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree, originally written by a schoolteacher called Marion Sinclair in the 1930s. It's a song, like in the tradition of all good folk songs, that's picked up choruses here and there. And although the original lyrics are all very sweet and innocent, some of the additions have included sticky ends for the kookaburra. And in this second stanza of Frieda Hughes's poem, we discover the sticky end that this particular kookaburra came to. But in the twilight, something got him. So close to the house, I should have heard. He was left like a taunt, a dead bird by an empty chicken run. We don't know what got him, something. It's Australia. It could be pretty much anything. I should have heard, the poet says. Either this is because of how loud the kookaburra is, so presumably it would make a lot of noise in a fight. But it also sounds a little protective or a little self-recriminating, as if the poet should have been keeping a lookout for the kookaburra. The pathetic corpse's proximity to the chicken run, perhaps implying that the poet has somehow failed in their duty. Frieda Hughes strikes a similar note in another poem in Warraloo. Fire One is the name of the poem, in which the poet says, "Still I didn't hear," as a fire breaks out, another disaster that results in animal death. So again, another example of the poet feeling this dim sense of guilt about not being fully alert, not keeping an ear out. Now, the fact that whatever got the kookaburra got him at twilight could change the meaning slightly of that "I should have heard." Kookaburras call at dusk and dawn. So if it was taken by whatever hideous Australian beast was prowling or slithering around, if it was taken mid-call, the poet could be saying, "I should have heard," as in, "I should have heard the sound, the call, the laughter, the chorus stop," not that "I should have heard a fight." There's something a little bit more melancholy about imagining not being able to hear something stop making a noise, as opposed to erupt in noise. Left like a taunt, which could either be the final taunt of the kookaburra, this trickster-like animal, this crafty, playful, laughing bird, or whatever the predator is, whatever it is, it means to torment the poet by leaving its prey like a taunt by the chicken run. Moving on to the third stanza, "Now his dusk-stained feathers rock in their dead grass cradle. His bitten body is the flame from which these moths escape." Here we have a very Plathian image, I think, of the livingness of death, the way in which death as the ultimate negative affects reversals. First, with the cradle, this incongruous image of new life and infancy, and then in the moth's bitten body being like a flame from which these moths escape, so there are bugs flying away from it, moths being conventionally traveling in the other direction towards flames and towards death. Here they are fleeing it to new life, fleeing the flame of the kookaburra's bitten body. In a review of Frieda Hughes's collection Warraloo, John Kinsella wrote that it explores how the poet restructures an often alien world to gain kinship with it, to open lines of communication in moments of the greatest despair. And I think we see a little bit of that in this image of life unexpectedly hatching from death. It's an image Frieda Hughes uses again in the collection in a poem Dead Cow, in which a similarly bug-riddled dead cow emits a last breath as her flesh offers up its children. Those children aren't calves, they're flies, but they are children nonetheless. It's a savage world, this one that Frieda Hughes presents, where creatures can barely move without causing damage. We see it again in the poem Birds, which is one of the poems Frieda Hughes said was explicitly based on her parents. The poet is a penguin sat in his snow cold, nursing the egg his wife had left him. There it was, born of them both, like it or not, rounded in words and cracking open its shell for a voice. Quite a provocative image, that, just like the kookaburra cracking branches with his laugh. Here, Frieda, imagining herself as a hatching penguin, surrounded by a shell that is rounded with words, the words of her poet parents, she has to crack this shell, she has to smash them up in order to find her own voice. I love the dusk-stained feathers of this stanza too. Kookaburras do have a kind of dusky coloration, sort of rufous and brown plumage. But also, since it was killed at twilight, it's almost like it's been stained with dusk, frozen in the dusk it was killed in. Moving on then to the fourth stanza. That beak is buried in the sucked out skull, where eyes were lost in another mouth. His small crate, anteaten already, has ribs open like rafters to welcome flies, and his wings rest like two open fans beside him. So the beak is buried in the sucked out skull, coming back to the idea of the carving knife lodged in its block. A little reminiscent too of Hughes's crow hopping around his palace of skulls, where eyes were lost in another mouth, a sort of gothic perversion of the romantic image of being lost in another's eyes. These are eyes that have been eaten, that have been lost in another's mouth. Also reminiscent of a bird poem of Plath's, Shrike, in which the jealousy-maddened shrike pecks out her lover's eyes to eat all they have seen in its dreams, her crowns, palace, all that night-long stole her mail. This idea that by eating eyes you would also eat what the eyes have seen, this rather gruesome idea of transference of sight by digestion, Frieda returns to in a poem that's about her mother called Readers, quite a famous poem this one, in which Frieda Hughes describes readers of Plath as predatory or as scavengers, living through her dead mother. They try to feather up the bird again, the vulture with its bloody head, inside its own belly, sucking up its own juice, working out its own shape, its own reason, its own death. They scooped out her eyes to see how she saw, and bit away her tongue in tiny mouthfuls to speak with her voice. The fact that the kookaburra's eyes are gone means that there is nothing to look back at the poet. The poet couldn't be more alone. We look to our, even if they are dead eyes, even if they are a doll's eyes, we look to eyes for meaning and for communication. And since they are hollowed out here, they've been taken by someone else, the poet is truly isolated. There is no possibility of communicating with something greater, the way that the narrator of a Ted Hughes poem does when he sees a kingfisher fly by, a sudden electric wire, through him, God whizzing in the sun, glimpses the angler. It's an extraordinary moment in the poem where we suddenly switch from the sort of human perspective to God's perspective through the eye of a kingfisher. Kingfishers, by the way, being the family of birds to which kookaburras belong. His small crate, anteaten already, has ribs open like rafters to welcome flies. Again, playing with the size of the kookaburra, his body is both a small crate and yet it has rafters big enough to welcome guests. As Frieda Hughes writes in another poem in this collection, of a bird's body, there is a city in there with its lights on. There's this potential for a body to become not just a single organism, but a host to a whole population. As it becomes here in this quite churchy sounding moment, the ribs open like rafters, the fans open at either side. I have to say it's very hard to read the line anteaten already without thinking of anteaters instead of being eaten by ants, which I'm pretty sure is what she's going for. And then we come to the final couplet of this short poem. Stripped of what made him, he is only a fraction of his noise. So stripped of what made him, again, the idea of the sound of the kookaburra being his life force, being his strength. I have to admit, when I first read this poem, Kookaburra, I couldn't get it out of my head that it might be about the death of Ted Hughes. The image, first of all, of a laughing kookaburra, a trickster-like member of the animal kingdom, not dissimilar to Ted Hughes's totemic crow. The fact that it was, as Ted Hughes is often described, so big in life, the head like a chopping block and beak like a carving knife isn't a million miles away. But more importantly than that, the idea that its life was its sound, its voice. Again and again, you will hear that said about Ted Hughes, the voice as in his poet's voice, but also his literal, his speaking voice, had a tremendous effect on people who heard it. But it isn't about Ted Hughes's death, unless it's a premonition of his death, because this collection came out in 1998, the same year that Ted Hughes died, but it actually came out before then. So I imagine the poem was written, some time before that. Notice that even though he has been stripped of what made him, even though he has lost his voice, he's still a self. It's not an it. It hasn't become that poundage of lard that Ted Hughes's dead pig becomes. He is only a fraction of his noise. We have the sense that his self is carrying on. He's still a he, even though he has been silenced. And by the way, in a certain sense, kookaburras really are their noise. The name kookaburra is a borrowing from the Aboriginal word for kookaburra, which was sort of an onomatopoeic pronunciation of its call. So it is its call, if you like. And as soon as it can't talk, it can no longer be itself. It can no longer describe itself, express itself. Frieda Hughes seems to pick up on this in the title poem from Warraloo when she says, I echo in my own emptiness like a tongue in a bird's beak. My words are all gone. Out of my mouth comes this dumb kookaburra laugh. How my feathers itch. It's as if in a moment of meaninglessness and a despair, the poet is just trying to articulate themselves and having to begin again at the most basic and crudest noise. There is another sense in which the kookaburra is only a fraction of his noise, and that would be as his part in the chorus. Kookaburras call together in great numbers. It's apparently a quite deafening sound when many kookaburras are calling at the same time, a crepuscular chorus at dusk. And of that chorus, this particular kookaburra was only a member, only a fraction of that noise. Kookaburras have to teach their young how to call. Their songs are learned songs, and mating pairs often duet, have a particular song that they can locate each other with. And perhaps by stepping in and taking that fraction of noise and making her own song of it, Frieda Hughes is effectively giving this poor kookaburra one last duet. After all, imitation goes both ways. So that's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode on Frieda Hughes's poem Kookaburra. If you want to check out any of my other episodes on Sylvia Plath or Ted Hughes, there's quite an extensive back catalogue now if you're just listening for the first time. I'll be back soon with another podcast, but in the meantime, happy reading.